I am Plato on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. In 2012, Marcello DiCintio began a residency at the Palestine Writing Workshop. While there, he led a course on creative nonfiction. Through this course, and just living outside of Ramallah, he gained insight into what life was like for Palestinians. A new e-book, Song of the Caged Bird, Words as Resistance in Palestine, looks at his time there, the writing of his students, and the insight he gained from what they wrote about. He also looks at how books and literature reflect the reality and history of Palestinians. Marcello DiCintio joins me now. I'll ask the award-winning writer and teacher about his travels to Palestine and what their bookshelves told him about their existence and more. This new e-book is a Hazlitt original from Knopf. The website for more is at marcellodicintio.com. His previous book, Walls, Travels Along the Barricades, won the 2013 Shaughnessy Cohen Prize for Political Writing. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Calgary today, Marcello DiCintio. Mr. DiCintio, good morning.
Good morning, hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So you've been to Palestine how many times?
Oh, maybe five or six times now.
The first time was at the dawn of the new millennium, as they say, right? 99?
Yeah, that's right. I kind of wanted to be somewhere interesting when the clock turned on 2000, and I figured Jerusalem would be the place.
Uh-huh, yeah. And so the last time you were there was at this time that you write about in 2012?
That's right.
Yeah. Would you explain to us, because we always hear this term writer in residence.
Mm-hmm.
Most people may not know what that involves. So you were selected as one of those for this writing workshop in Palestine. Is that correct?
Yeah. In this case, as a writer in residence, I was there to teach Palestinian students. And to come up with a course. In my case, because I'm a creative nonfiction writer, I did a course in creative nonfiction with 9 students. Three were not Palestinian by ethnicity; they were American women who had married Palestinian men. But most of the students were Palestinian women.
And so, was that your goal there to teach, or was that also to do some writing on your own?
Well, the residency itself is a teaching position.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But while I was there, I wanted to find things for myself to write about. I spent a full month there, which is longer than most of the residents who go. And the point of that was to find stories that I hadn't written about, stories that I hadn't read about Palestine and life there. And that was what led me to the book in the first place. I mean, I wanted to write about the occupation and about life in Palestine from a different angle. I knew I couldn't avoid talking about politics, but I did want to come at it dead on, straight on. And so I looked to reading and writing and literary culture in Palestine as kind of my back door into the situation, the theme I wanted to work on.
When you talk about seeking a different angle, say, about that part of the world, where does that come from, do you think, the way we view Palestine heretofore? Is that because of sort of the news coverage of what happens there? Are there Palestinian poets, writers, that we simply don't know about, do you think? Or what do you think it is about what we know of that place so far?
Well, there's a whole vibrant arts culture there that we don't know anything about, and I think the reason why is that we only hear one story. We hear a story about occupation, right? And no matter what side of the conflict your sympathies lie, that's the only story we hear. Palestinians are either violent extremists who are fighters, or they're freedom fighters, or they're desperate refugees, but we only see them in that one lens, right? That the single story of Palestinians is one of their response to the conflict. We don't see them as artists and as poets and as dancers and as people, human beings who strive to live regular lives, who eat food, who have romances, who love their wives and they love their families. We don't see that as much because everything we see is kind of through this one prism.
And they love their books, don't they?
And they love their books.
Yeah. What's the literacy rate in Palestine like?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't have a number in front of me.
I did hear one time, and I can't remember where, that it is quite high.
I suspect it's very high.
Yeah. So what do Palestinians read?
Certainly amongst Palestinians, and I think in the Arab and Muslim world in general, in the Middle East in general, poetry is kind of the highest of the literary forms. The great Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish is someone that everyone has read. They seek out kind of fiction. Novels is not a huge genre, but one that's growing amongst Palestinian readers. But I think I think everyone reads a little bit of poetry, at the very least.
And the rate of piracy, that's quite high.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to, and I write about it in my little book here. I write about whenever something becomes popular, it immediately becomes pirated, and because there's not a kind of a structure of enforcement around copyright laws within Palestine, there's very little that can be done about it. So you get kind of cheap printed copies of books that end up in bookstores, actually.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a no-win, because either you're an unknown Palestinian writer who's self-publishing his or her book and, you know, selling it to friends and family, the same way that we do it here with our own self-published books, and it kind of goes nowhere in the market, or else, you know, it becomes popular and then it becomes pirated, and they lose out on the royalties there anyway. So unless you're a well-known author who can publish outside of Palestine, the way Darwish did, for example, it's tough to it's tough to make a living as a writer anywhere.
Yeah.
Trust me. but I suspect it's even more difficult in a place like Palestine, which has these pressures.
Yeah, this is the political pressures of the books where they're printed can't be admitted into
exactly
the area.
Right.
Yeah. You mentioned Darwish. He's highly regarded in Palestine amongst Palestinians, because, I mean, on his death, I guess that was a few years back now, mm-hmm. It was just a huge outpouring of memorializing, I mean, to the point of rivaling that which happened during Arafat's death,
oh,
I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah. He's well known outside of the area, right?
Yes.
I've never encountered his work. I don't really read poetry very much, but in terms of his work, is that something that you'd read a lot of before you went there?
I read a fair bit of Darwish. I'm more interested. I don't think his stuff translates well into English, to be perfectly honest.
Mm-hmm.
I was more interested in him as a figure, as a literary figure, as a political figure. He's as close to a saint as the Palestinians have had. You know, the man, it was so well regarded, and so beloved by everybody. Yeah, he's only the second person to receive a state funeral after Arafat, and I would propose that he's probably more universally loved than Arafat was amongst the Palestinians. I was very interested in his take on the role of literature within the Palestinian culture. Especially there was one thing that gets to me all the time, and I was really enjoyed reading about it, was how as a famous Palestinian writer, he was expected to always write about politics, to always write about the occupation, and fill his poems with those motifs of resistance and of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally, I mean, he would write about things like love, and would get criticized for that, and say, you know, how could you write about love while under occupation? And what he said was, I wish I had the quote in front of me, was something along the lines of, you know, I write love poems as an act of resistance against people who say I should not write love poems. He says that the idea that Palestinians should be able to be frivolous on the page is in a way an act of resistance. It is a way of living a normal life in spite of everything else. And I saw that within my own students' writing, too, how I half expected, when I asked my students to write about their life experiences, that they would all give me occupation stories.
Uh-huh.
I suspected maybe that's what they thought I would want to read, or what they as Palestinians were expected to write. And I got very few of those. And much to my surprise, I got, you know, quote-unquote frivolous stories, stories about family dynamics and love and
ice cream
and vacations and this sort of stuff. And that, to me, was the first time, and that was my first assignment that I got back from them, were stories like this. And that was my first kind of look into a life, a complete Palestinian life, a life outside of the politics. I mean, surrounded by it, yeah. but somehow separate from it at the same time.
Yeah, the sense that I got is that there's more to that part of the world, more to Palestine than, say, what we read about in the newspaper.
Of course.
Yeah. One of the pieces that you got from your students, which you described beautifully in this book, was the one written by Hannah.
Yes.
What did she write about?
It was funny. Well, not funny at all. I mean, it was like the first story that came in from Hannah was a story about her a argument that she got in with her father, who was very conservative and who didn't respect Hannah's lack of religious conservatism. And it's a scene that she writes from her home, a shouting match that ends with her father actually threatening to kill her. And that came into my inbox from Hannah, you know, my first week there in Beer Zeit at the residency, and I didn't know what to do with it. I mean, it was shocking. It was incredibly written. It was very raw. And as an outsider and as a male outsider, I didn't know what, if any, responsibility I had for that or how I should respond to it. It was really troubling. I mean, it spoke to this potential for violence that I didn't know how to deal with. And again, nothing to do with occupation, but just the sorts of kind of domestic struggles that regular people go through.
Mm-hmm.
It was a tough one for sure. And as I write in the book, I kind of, in a way, perhaps cowardly, hid behind kind of writing residency conventions. And instead of talking to Hannah about the seriousness of what she was writing about, I talked about her use of pacing and metaphor and it's kind of hiding behind regular writing instructor responses. But it was something else. And what was interesting too, that when she returned, when I first had met her, she was in hijab. She had her head covered. And the next class, you know, when we were there to discuss her story, she'd removed her hijab. She had given up wearing the headscarf. And in light of the story that she had written, that in itself was this incredible moment. And all the other students had also read her story and were quite taken aback by suddenly Hannah had abandoned her religious head covering. It was quite an incredible moment, and so early on in my residency, it was quite a shock.
So, how many people were in the class?
I had 9 women,
and
women just by chance. I mean, I don't know why men didn't sign up.
And they varied in ages. Is that right?
Yeah, most of the Palestinian women, I guess, were in their early 20s. The 3 Americans were a little bit older. But yeah, they're kind of young, mostly young Palestinian women.
Did they tell you, did you get a sense at all as to why they were there?
They're there for the same reason that people attend my classes here in Canada, is that they want to be better writers.
Hmm.
They were very literate. They wanted to be better writers in English as well. I mean, all the assignments were done in English for me because I don't speak Arabic.
Huh.
But they were voracious readers and enthusiastic writers, and they wanted to be better at it.
We talked about Darvish a moment ago. I forgot to ask you: have you got writing rituals that you practice when you're writing yourself? I mean, you're quite evocative in how you describe the things that he did how he treated the process of writing. I mean, it was very sacred.
Yeah, absolutely. He has great rituals. I wish I did. I'm still trying to figure out what they are. You know, I'm 42. I've been doing this for a while, and I've yet to find my effective ritual. If I'm open to suggestions.
Maybe he would use a certain cup. He would dress for when he sat down.
Yeah, you know? he put on a jacket and a pressed shirt. You know, like he was going to work instead of. You know, I'm standing. I sit at my computer with in my pajamas for most of the day. I mean, I don't know. I think I could learn a lesson from Darvish.
You went to a prison in Nablus, is that right?
I went to a prisoner's library.
Oh, I see. Okay, and so did you have a sense of what you would find there before you got there?
I had heard about this room in the Nablus Municipal Library that had collected books from prisons that had been shut down.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that was in there would be prisoners' books, but I had no idea what kind of books they'd be there or kind of the stories that'd be behind these books or the contraband that I found.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the most enjoyable find during the whole process of writing this book was finding a book in that library that the librarian showed me where the prisoners had hollowed it out and was using it to smuggle notes back and forth. You know, not drugs, not weapons, but notes. And these notes were still inside this hollowed out book, written on the paper peeled from the back of cigarette foil.
Uh-huh.
And in this tiny, almost microfilm small hand, handwritten in Arabic, and the messages were political messages. This was back during the First Intifada, where people political prisoners were Marxists and would talk about we taught each other Marxist thought and philosophy and that sort of thing, and they would pass these notes back and forth, and it was incredible to see to actually hold in my hands this kind of contraband notes. And also the sense that, you know, words could be as contraband as drugs or weapons, right? Like kind of the power and danger of words, that they had to sneak them to and from each other within the prison. I found that really fascinating.
Well, what were some of the books that they'd read? Was it mainly communist stuff?
A lot of it was, yeah. A lot of it was. This was kind of like before kind of political Islam took over from Marxist thought. You know, this is during the Soviet era, and so there was a lot of Marxist books. There was a lot of books that were critical of American politics.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of that stuff too, and there was a lot of books about other independence movements around the world. A lot of those too. One of the interesting ones too that I found in there was a book of songs written about Nelson Mandela, who at the time was also a prisoner. And so, and this book had the English lyrics on one side of the page, the Arabic translation on the other side of the page. And handwritten on those pages in pencil were the kind of the pronunciation marks, the diacritical marks in Arabic. So, which kind of proved that not only were these Palestinian prisoners reading these songs about Mandela, they were singing them. They were pronouncing them out loud, which was a really interesting thing too, right? We got these two kinds of prisoners on languishing in prison, one thinking about the other.
Yeah, I mean, it's just fascinating, sort of the stuff that you got to see in that library. The bookstores, are there a lot of them in Palestine?
I would say there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
There's some great ones, but there's not a lot of bookstores.
The one that you went to was the one Edward Said's family owned. Is that right?
Edward Said had owned the building before I was taken over by the current family that has educational bookshop. It's got the worst.
Yeah.
It sounds like the most uninviting name for a bookstore I'd ever heard of. But it's a great spot. I think certainly any English speaking visitor to Jerusalem needs to go and see that place. It's a wonderful repository of political books and Palestinian poetry and fiction, and it's kind of like a almost like a meeting place for liberal English-speaking visitors to Palestine, in Jerusalem.
When you think about your time there and you think about all these experiences that you had there and the ones that you relate to us in this new book, Song of the Caged Bird. There are lessons here, aren't there, for Canadians like you and I, as to how we ought to view words, how we ought to view books, mm-hmm. how we ought to view literature, that they are a form of resistance and that there is great redemption in them.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a great democracy to them too, right? I mean, uh-huh. in a place where literacy is high and everyone can read and write, that's a form of expression that's available to everyone. And it's a way to and this became very important. Is very important, I think, for the Palestinians, they've written themselves into existence, right? These books that I saw, some very very old, some very very new, are evidence of the existence of a rich and developed culture, and that that in itself is a political statement. When we talk about, do Palestinians exist? Have they always existed? Is this a real place and a real people? These words scrawled into these old books are evidence of that. It shows that, and it shows too how sophisticated the Palestinians have been. These are not miserable old ladies living in tents in refugee camps. These are people who had a vibrant and beautiful culture, and the evidence of that is within these old books.
Now, how did this ebook come about? For people listening to us, it's not a long read, but it's I guess people can get this online. Is that right for their e-readers?
Yeah, it'll be sold as an Amazon, as a Kindle, like for a Kindle off of Amazon, and off of the Hazlitt site will also, you can purchase it off that as well. Yeah, so the digital only.
Yeah,
so you read it off a device.
Did they come to you, and or did you have all this stuff written, and then you went to them? How did this come about?
I had spent my time in Palestine, had done research about this, and was looking for a place to publish it. And this Hazlitt original idea is kind of a perfect. It's kind of a sweet length.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing itself is about 15,000 words, which is far too long for most magazines. To publish, and much much too short for a book, and so you know Hazlitt there's other companies like Hazlitt that put these short mm-hmm. pieces of nonfiction together, and it was a kind of a sweet length, you know, so I was quite happy when they showed interest in my idea and decided to publish it.
When I finished it a couple of days ago, I longed for say you know for some parts of it to be longer. I mean,
sure.
do you have that feeling as well, that you could go longer, say, expanding some of the parts of this?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll consider that, too. I mean, there's so much more of Palestinian literary culture that I could have talked about and just didn't get to. It would require, you know, another trip, at least one or two more trips into the country. But there's part of me, too, that feels that it's unfinished, that there's a lot more to be said.
Hey, like I wondered about what it was like living there day to day.
It was wonderful, you know. I was in Birzeit, which is a village where the university is, and a lovely old village. And you know, I've traveled a lot. I'm a travel writer primarily, and traveled a lot around the world and a lot through the Middle East. And the Middle East is always very hospitable. The people who live there are incredibly hospitable. But in Palestine, there's something even more to the hospitality because of the situation, because of the occupation, they are incredibly grateful that you choose to go there and to bear witness back when you return home. You know, I would go into a cafe and have a coffee, and the cafe owner would thank me for coming to Palestine. You know, I got that all the time there, and not just thank you for patronizing my shop, but thank you for coming here, and there was always that sense that. They were grateful for someone coming to bear witness to the situation there, and I feel a great amount of responsibility to that same effort.
And it was. I mean, did you find living there fun? I mean,
absolutely, yeah. Great coffee shops,
yeah.
Great bars, lots to read, lots to do. Great restaurants. I mean, all that stuff that you want in a place, Ramallah and Birzeit and all that. They had that as well, right? No, I really had a good time there.
What's next for you, Marcello? Are you working on another book now?
Oh, I'm still searching for the next big project. Maybe it's expansion of the Palestinian literary culture idea. Maybe not. I do a lot of magazine work, so I'm kind of focusing on that right now. But I'm getting itchy for a big project. My last book, Walls, was a 4.5-year effort, mm-hmm. and while I never want to go through that again, I would like something to keep my attention for a couple of years. I'm still looking for whatever that'll be.
Marcel, this is such a great read. I hope a lot of people get it.
Well, thank you very much.
I appreciate your time today. Thanks for this.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You can get the book off of Hazlitt's website. And then, of course, marcellodecintio.com is the website for the author. The book is called Song of the Caged Bird, Words as Resistance in Palestine. It's a Hazlitt original published by Knopf. Its author, Marcello DeCintio, joined me on the line from Calgary. In Vancouver, I'm Joel Suplanta.